Welcome to the PEPM podcast, a research into practice conversation between pre-service and in-service teachers and teacher educators about research and practice. For episode 13, I'm joined by one pre-service teacher, one in-service teacher, three university teacher educators and the author to discuss Brian Culp's 2020 paper, Third Space Investigations, Geography, Dehumanisation and Seeking Spatial Justice for Kinesiology from Quest. We begin with an around-the-table discussion. Over to you, Cam.
What I took from this was essentially when we're teaching, where we find ourselves teaching, that's the space in which we are teaching, as in the wider community. And often we can't change that, but what we can change as teachers is the opportunities that we provide to our learners and the perceptions of those spaces that we try to get them to take on. So how we want them to perceive their spaces and their peers' experiences. And then I thought to myself, well, how can we do that? And for me, it was ourselves being educated enough to know not just what's right and wrong, but deeper issues that are long-standing, newer, everything like that. And then enforcing, maybe it is the right word, that through our expectations and our standards of the pupils consistently, so that any long-standing preconceptions of space and what that means to young people are cut out, and there isn't space for that within our PE if we're looking at it just within our lessons. And then also making sure we're enforcing those standards and expectations around school.
So when going over the blog and even the other article that was posted on Shape, there was a lot of information and word usage that was very familiar with my experiences and deconstructing what I thought phys ed was and how to reevaluate where I was to make sure the students were in better positions to, one, not just succeed, but feel welcomed. Because whatever space I came into already had that symbol, I guess, like what everybody already thought of that space. So there's already assumptions going into it. And I think you did a great point in kind of breaking down the third space, which is one that's never popped into my brain before, but there's a lot of truth to it and how that space is viewed. And I think there was like a example of it, it's like zooming in. So it's like you see that from the outside and then you zoom in and in, and then you're actually looking for what does that space mean. Obviously, I've been very superficial with how I view those spaces prior to my experiences, because I lived in middle of Lancaster County, PA, where it's 99% white, and I haven't been exposed to different cultures outside of just friends, and it's very limited. So what I found out was when I went into schools within Philadelphia, you had to recreate that space. But using your authority to be the person for stability in that section, whereas the students help you create that space. So there was a lot of familiarity, and like the successes that I've had definitely fall in line with a lot of what you talked about. I was trying to think of things to challenge, and there really wasn't, like questioning. Nope. It's just kind of like, this has happened, this has worked. So this is like a good piece to see. And I might actually just steal this and use this for my cafe talk later tonight with local members within Philadelphia. Because sometimes as an educator, we will make assumptions about what the space should be. And being in Philadelphia, you look at the playgrounds from a distance. Looks like a playground. You zoom in, there's really nothing there, and that space is pretty much like a prison yard. The same thing with the gymnasiums. So even for me coming into those spaces, knowing my experiences, and I've switched from high school to elementary, there's still so much baggage associated with the schools that we're not addressing. We're just doing band-aid routines. So this is like a very refreshing piece to see. So thank you for writing this.
Hello, Brian. Lovely to see you and share a space with you once again. Long time no see. I love the paper. I'm completely biased. I love all of your work. I read all of your work in my doctorate program right after I read. I took a doctoral class and we had to pick a scholar and we had to read all of their work and do a literature review. And I picked Richard Tinning. Yeah. And I had so much to get through. And then after that, I went down your rabbit hole and ended up reading all yours. And my favorite paper of yours is Illegitimate Bodies. It was published quite a while ago. That's my favorite paper because it just sums up what practice that still happens in physical education, especially in England now. And I love the current paper, the one that Ash has written this, you know, this blog and this think piece on. And it reminded me of a doctoral class I took about 4 years ago, back when I was a doc student, wishing I had that time back. And it was a qualitative inquiry class, and we discussed qualitative inquiry three, and we discussed like cartography and different spaces and critical geography. And so it's definitely an area that I need to go back to now I'm, you know, in the field. I think this idea around like it's our ethical duty to make sure that we're in each of those spaces, but also listening and being quiet in spaces when necessary. And I think you make that point, and I think Ash definitely highlights that point in the blog. Like sometimes we need to be quiet and we need to know when to be quiet in a certain space and let other voices talk. And we don't always get it right, actually. I know I don't always get it right as an educator, but it's a process. It's a process. So thank you. Thank you. It's lovely to see you. I'll hand over now. I think Clancy, are you next?
Thanks, Sheree. Nice to see you, Sheree, too. And thanks, Brian, for joining. The last time, speaking of space, the last time that we had a chance, Brian, to share a space was, I hate to say it, although we've chatted several times over the last couple of years, but it was 2018 in Nashville when we were sharing the space of a hockey arena watching the Toronto Maple Leafs beat the Nashville Predators. Talking about sharing space. So that was a good time. And again, thanks for joining us. I agree a lot with what Sheree has to say. And I was particularly intrigued by the discussion of space and power that you bring up. You know, in public, well, in education as a whole, we are thinking about being culturally responsive. We're thinking about being inclusive. We're thinking about trauma-informed care now, as per last week. We're thinking about a lot of these inclusive pedagogies. Yet, as you point out in your manuscript, we have this EdTPA in the United States that seems to do the exact opposite. And that kind of points to what we've talked about in previous weeks with being the neoliberal context. And we have assessments, and we have these types of power tensions that are embedded deeply within that really tie into not only the power itself, but the space that we have to think about moving forward. So much like what Sheree said, I took a lot from this manuscript, Brian. Kudos to you. I have some more points that I'll share, but I'll, like what Sheree said, I'm going to practice and not talk too much and pass it on.
Yeah, so thanks, Brian, for the piece, and Ash for the great blog. You know, what I brought this back to was the role of the community spaces. And so a lot of the stuff that I've done is in after-school programs, and we work in the community spaces. But what I realize is, you know, doing this kind of deep dive into different curriculum or across the world, you see things like the New Zealand curriculum that focus on the community. And they understand that, hey, PE can't do everything. So we need to communicate with the community to make sure that we have physical activity spaces and programs and things to supplement. And I don't think the US curriculum really takes that into consideration. And, you know, the Virginia content standards are being redone, and Dominique Banville and I at Mason, we wrote an open letter to them about talking about getting into that community space. And, you know, I'll bring an example of the program that we ran in Fullerton. You know, this program we ran on campus in an after-school program at an elementary school. It has these huge fences around the entire school. So during school hours, they are allowed to play there. And after school, they lock up the fences and you can't use that green space. You can't use that playground. Because in the US, we're so worried about being sued, or we're worried about vandalism or whatever it is. So they're like, no access. So the park directly across the street from that school was this park that was occupied by homeless people. So the students would, and we interviewed these students, that students would not want to go into that space because they were afraid, or their parents forbade them because people were out there, whether it was community members drinking or, you know, doing stuff that, you know, they don't want their kids around. So there were these places that were green spaces, but they were not available. And this was exactly, you talked about this, Brian, of the train tracks dividing cities. And so our students went to school on the west side of the train tracks. The school with the after school program was on the east side. And literally these were only, it was only 3 miles to get from campus to the school. But most of our students have never crossed the train tracks. And this is like Southern California, Orange County, very wealthy area. It's not like, you know, but there was such a difference between that train track to the other side. And I just feel like there's so many community spaces, even though you might drive through a community and go, oh, there's a lot of parks here. But do we have access to those parks? Right. So that's what I got. Love to hear some responses.
Okay, so Brian, over to you. I mean, it's, you know, you can respond to people, you can do whatever you want, really. Your song.
Well, I first of all, I appreciate all the positive thoughts on the literature. I mean, I think when we all do work, so first of all, you know, hello, colleagues and friends, because I know pretty much all of you have seen, read a lot of your work, and you're doing amazing things as yourself. So I'm glad that it is somewhat of a focus point for maybe some thoughts down the road. But, you know, really the genesis of this, when I was talking about Third Space, probably came about 2 years ago. Is some of the things that we see here in the United States of America and across the world, particularly pertains to Black Lives Matter and what that actually means. And for a person like me, who is an African-American Black male in a space where I'm looking at physical education programs and how they're being created, even before COVID, and recognizing the fact that, you know what, we have youth out here who are getting killed. And they're getting killed specifically because people do not necessarily know how to negotiate, navigate space, or people are bringing, people in power are bringing their biases into the space. So I really started thinking about Trayvon Martin. Like, Trayvon Martin is always on my mind when I think about this issue with space, because it's just like, I mean, it's been 8 years, and that young man, irrespective of all the other stuff going on, was literally minding his business, like eating Skittles and walking home, something that 90% of our students will do, like something very normal. And someone in power decided that he wasn't worthy enough of walking home and decided to escalate a situation. So the space and power thing, I'm glad people brought that up, because that was really sort of what I was trying to get to as a central point to talk about how many situations are we all in? Because if in that situation, we're talking about Black versus a person who's biracial, who identifies as white and Hispanic, versus a Black youth. But how many situations are we in on a daily basis where we have the opportunity to actually add something of value to our students, but our biases keep us from presenting physical education that's inclusive? And the second thing I'd probably say in terms of what I'm also thinking about currently is, how does reentry, quote unquote, if you want to use that word, look given COVID-19? Because I'm sitting there thinking about these scenarios, and I mean, all of us have posted on this on Twitter or social media. I mean, you know, there's a conversation here a few weeks ago, Joe Wicks PE, what does that mean at the end of the day for people, right? It's horrible that, but we have students now who are looking through the lens of technology, and that technology is framing what they think of physical education on one end. And on the other end, if you were a great physical education teacher and had a great program, you're in a situation now where your students have missed that, in some cases for months, in some cases maybe even for a year. In some cases here in the United States, they've been talking about not even really having physical education back. They've been talking about bringing testing back.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are my initial sort of thoughts on this idea of space. And to Steve's point, like, at what point do we let the students sort of control and create what this is going to be for them? And now, last thing I'll say about this, and we'll talk about, because there's just so many things running through my head right now, so I have to apologize for that, because everybody brought some really good points here that we can just kind of flesh out for the next few minutes. But, you know, so this is generational as well. I think we have to understand that. So when we plan curriculum, a lot of times it's often through the lens of what we are currently experiencing, not what the students who are coming behind will be experiencing in the future. And I think that's a really big thing that we've sort of neglected. So when we get these students in class who don't feel like they have a voice, and then they turn into a classroom management issue, and then we sort of say to ourselves, well, you're a management problem. And sometimes it may not be a management issue. It's just the fact that those particular students are coming from a different world. They're coming from a different space. We have a pre-practice curriculum or curriculum with models that I always make this point. The models of physical education, if you ask me, and I'm really biased, I think they're all good. Problem is when do they work in terms of time, right? And who's delivering that content? And again, these are things that we already sort of know. But at what point are we going to let students try to interpret what those models are and have the time to be able to do it? So those were my initial thoughts. And I'm going to be quiet right now, respecting space, and kind of see what else comes out of this.
So now it's my turn, and I'm going to dodge the models question, because that could just take us down a whole different path I don't want to go down at the moment. But we could do, I think, I made notes, as I always do, and I'm going to go back to them. Normally, I start at the beginning, but I'm going to pick something up, which Brian said, is what do spaces look like post-COVID? And I'm really interested in that comment is, what do those spaces look like when people haven't been in them for a year? What do those spaces look like when black and brown and white and Hispanic bodies haven't been in those spaces together ever because they haven't been in those positions? What do those spaces look like when people have forgotten how to be in those spaces together? And I think there's some really, and I never thought of that, but I think some really powerful stuff around how those spaces have metamorphosized over the last 12 months and how they are different now to the way they were before, and how the political environment in the US has changed the spaces as well. So these are spaces that haven't been occupied for a long time are now being occupied with new realizations and understandings on the table. So, you know, I think that's a really interesting and powerful place to look. And I'm going to go back now, but that was my first thought. But can we use the word enforcing, and then you questioned yourself? And actually what I wrote down is, do we actually provide the time to do that? So when we hear the racist comment, or when we hear the sexist comment, or where we see this and when we see that, do we take the time to move away from what we were talking about to redress that? So, you know, I think the enforcing is if we want things to change, then I think enforcing is a good word in terms of, but we have to make time for it. That was the kind of thing I was thinking. And Steve, you talked about zooming in, and Mikhail Kavenistat talked about this process of zooming in and zooming out. Sometimes we have to zoom out and we have to look at what's happening. So when you observe teaching from outside of a classroom and then you're kind of zoomed out, but you do need to zoom in and see what's happening in those tiny interactions and those spaces. I think those dialogues and those conversations are really interesting. I like the idea of cartography. If someone could, Sri, you mentioned this, if you could actually map out a classroom, how would you represent it? What would it look like? Where's no man's land? Where's the bits you can go? Where's the bits you can't go? And it occurs in a school as well. So I thought that was a really interesting analogy. And I don't know what an edge TPA is, by the way, but I'm assuming it's something to do with testing and standardized testing and neoliberal spaces. Sri is laughing her head off at me, but we don't like it as a concept. But
horrendous.
Yes, we've had discussions about this previously, so I'm aware it's horrendous. And how are those spaces set up? And you know, we have a selective grammar school system in the UK, and actually I taught in a selective grammar school before I came here, so I understand it. And both my kids that went to did the standardized testing to go into the selective grammar school, and both of them didn't make it quite, and it was the best thing that ever happened to them, because people get lost in selective grammar schools at the age of 11 by the time they're 16, because they can pass an IQ test, and you know, we're missing some of that culturally responsive stuff, and people have their kids tutored for 2 years to pass the test. And that's about social positioning, that's about, you know, perceptions of worth, that's about all sorts of stuff, and the pressure that goes on those young children to pass those tests is phenomenal. And so that's what I was looking at there. And then Risto, you were talking about spaces, and I remember when I went to a school to watch a PE lesson as an external examiner, I walked from the school down the road into a field, past a burnt out car, into a field where the worst discus lesson I've ever seen in my life was taught. But the spaces just weren't, you know, that's where they had to go. There wasn't the cost of land in London, the facilities weren't there. And I'm brought back to two incidences, and I'd really like to sort of put a finish on this. So there's one that we went to Glasgow to see a friend of ours, and she was trained to be a doctor, and we got into a taxi to go into the city centre. And she started to have a conversation in a language I've never understood and never heard before in my life, which is actually English. But the broad Glaswegian accent that went into that was just, I didn't understand a word that was said. And then it reminded me that when I was in New York for ARA, Sarah and I got the train, the subway to the airport. We got off at the wrong station. We ended up somewhere in, I don't know the map, but probably in deep, dark Queens somewhere. And my imagination at that point kicked off, and a lady came towards us, and she spoke to me again in an accent. It was an American accent, but I couldn't tell you for love nor money what was said, and it reminds me of this Glaswegian incident. And I didn't know what to do. I absolutely had no idea, A, what she said to me, where I work was and what I was doing. And being in that space, both in the taxi cab and both on the subway station, were difficult places to be. And I didn't have the vocabulary, literally the vocabulary, but I didn't understand those spaces. And I think that's really important when we're talking about this, is how do we understand not the spaces we're comfortable with, although I think we need to re-understand the spaces we're comfortable with, but how do we understand the spaces that scare us, that make us uncomfortable, and how do we deal with those? And I'm throwing that back open to everybody to respond in any way they wish to what I've just said.
I can jump in to two things. You know, the point about spaces and feeling uncomfortable, and, you know, what do spaces look like post-COVID? And the only thing that I can really say related to that is that spaces are full of possibilities, and we have to be uncomfortable going into some spaces and think, I don't know what's going to come out of this, but it gives us an opportunity to reimagine spaces with our students and see what they want it to look like. And I think that's powerful.
I'll jump in, Sri. I agree. I took the same Same point. You know, apologies to Ash. I thought of that after when I mentioned the EdTPA. The EdTPA is a teacher certification exam that's in place in many states in the U.S. And I would argue that we're trying to think of education from an inclusive context in a lot of ways, but yet that EdTPA seems to be, in my mind, exclusive, and that gets into that discussion that we talked about before. But, you know, I think Sri captures the point that I was going to respond, you know, and I Ash recounted a story where he was in an uncomfortable situation, and I can do the same. And, you know, Ash asks a great question, and I think the other part of that question is that the person or people that are uncomfortable are putting their trust in others and or could be vulnerable to place their trust in other people's hands. And I think that, as Sri mentioned, is very powerful. So much like what Brian said and Sri alluded to, we can think about after COVID as you know, as possibly a deficit, but maybe this is a great opportunity for a new space in PE to capture many of the things we're chatting about over the last several months on this podcast. Brian said some poignant words that I circled here. Care is a language of its own in that manuscript that transcends geography, that transcends any, you know, status. That transcends, period. And I think, just like Sri said, I think care and the possibilities are truly powerful moving forward.
Yeah, I the idea of going into scary spaces, when I moved to New York, I got a kindergarten teaching job in Central Harlem on 133rd and 5th, like right in the smack dab in the middle of Harlem. And I remember walking in that community and looking around, and like I was the only white person that I could see in that community walking. And that was a really drastic change for me coming from Southern California, growing up in Finland, which you just say Finland, like you just look at that as a homogenous country of, you know, mostly white. And so it was really tough for me in the beginning because I kept on thinking like, what's gonna happen to me? What's happening? People just mind their own business. Like I'm just walking to work. I'm just another person in that community who's working. And it makes me wonder, because in those 4 years living in New York, I drastically changed how I think, how I talk, what my belief system is, because I was forced to be uncomfortable. And I wonder how many of our students in predominantly white institutions have been the other. And have been the other in a space that's not theirs. And I'm not talking about flying to Thailand and being a tourist and just understanding like, oh, I'm just coming in here, but being in a community in your country, in your state, in your city, that you are the other person. And I don't think that that experience happens as often as it needs to be.
Well said. That's kind of where I got my start for really expanding my understanding of what's going on in the world was New York City as well. Like I taught a little bit in the South Bronx through a after-school baseball program, which was very eye-opening. But I guess when we're looking at spaces, a lot of that for me has been almost, I guess the easiest way for me to explain it is you're almost like an archaeologist, where you're trying to understand the history and the complexities that are actually occurring in the neighborhoods and the community so that you actually understand where you are. Because realistically in Philadelphia, I live in the same neighborhood that I taught high school in. It was a block to block thing. So there are students that are safe on one block and they're comfortable in that space. They go 50 yards, they're in no man's land. They're in a space that their life can be taken. And having that understanding of how complex the environment is, where they are negotiating, they are making compromises, they're in conflict constantly. So their nature is conflict, and they're always trying to negotiate how to get through the day. It's really important to have that understanding, that community, And even for me, who's very well aware of that, ironically enough, during COVID, for many students, the safest space was actually virtual. It's not even going back to the school. Like, we're dealing with box fans being put in a window for COVID. I don't even want to say like what's in my brain, because that will get like a little beep mark, but the insanity in which we're treating people because they're not part of the main group blows my mind. So like right now it's like a fight in Philly about fans, ventilation, building conditions. It's not about just sending kids back anymore, because you're going to send kids back into a space where you're actually probably going to do more harm than good. Where our school's only bringing back 10 out of 135 kids from K to second grade. So it's like, all right, these 10 kids, five a day roughly, are now going to be placed in a room that's literally going to mimic prison. You are stuck to that desk. You are stuck to that box. And I know how teachers are going to handle this. So dealing with like the conflict of getting in a space that's uncomfortable, sometimes it's literally just exploring it, taking your own. And that's kind of like what I'm trying to say here is explore it, understand where it comes from, understand where it's going, and understand where the actual people, the community, wish for it to go.
I think those have been some great points. I mean, and one of the things I think about when looking at this work in geography and looking at cities is the question of, and I think all of us have touched on this here, who has the right to the city, right? And I'm not the one that came up with that particular context. I mean, this has been discussed before in geography as it relates to like urban cities, urban growth. Like, what does this mean as everything is expanding out and that the lines are becoming a little bit more blurred? But really, when I look at the vision of what physical education is, and I look at it over the history of what it's been in the United States, I think we've gotten away from that. It's just been so much of a focus on this importance on motor skills. And then it's sort of a focus on, well, we'll have some social, emotional aspects to it, which are fine, but there's not any explicit discussion of inequality and class and how those make a difference, whether you're in a heterogeneous group, right? Because you can be, for instance, you know, I grew up in an all-Black neighborhood, and there were some significant class differences in that. I was a bus kid. I was a latchkey Generation X bus kid. And it completely changed. And for those people who don't know, latchkey kid was basically, you know, when you're younger in elementary school, you walk through blocks to school and you come back, you key in. There's not a whole lot of parents around. Now, again, keep in mind, this is like the 80s. So you'll probably get in trouble for this now. But you key in and your parents are off at work and they've left you specific instructions on what to do. You have your snack, you watch, you know, Mr. Rogers. That's gonna date myself a little bit here. But whatever you watch, Thundercats, whatever it is, that's it. You do your homework, you eat your snack, and then your parents come home. And you grow up a little bit differently. When I came to high school, it was a completely different situation, because then I was busing to a different part of the district that went to a predominantly white school. And the culture of a bus kid, quote unquote, and the culture of a latchkey kid versus the culture of a child whose parents can drop them off and pick them up every day. Those are three very specific, and we're not even talking about all these other elements. Those are three very specific elements there. So we look at these things to me and I go, what is physical education doing to prepare students, prepare them to be future adults, and to be comfortable with navigating these different places? I mean, as we've mentioned here before, we have a lot of people right now that are angry, and they're angry for legitimate reasons. And this is, you can look at, you know, different sides of the spectrum for this. I mean, you know, if we go on social media, I'm afraid to read tweets most of the time, because they can take you down some rabbit holes where people are really upset and they have some legitimate reasons why they're upset about this. But I think the other piece of this, and I'll just leave this alone for now, but I think we haven't grieved. I think we have not put situations for our students and even ourselves as teachers and practitioners to talk about what Judith Butler talks about, which is grieving. This idea of a grievable life, which is, you know, if you can't grieve loss, then is it life, right? And that's a really deep concept to kind of think about, but there's been a lot of death the past few years. And we're putting students back into a school environment and saying everything is okay, but we're not giving them, to the point about space, an opportunity for them to express what that's meant the past few years. We're telling them what that means, but they're not getting an opportunity to sort of express how that all is. So those are just some thoughts.
Cam, did you want to come in? You don't have to. But I want to give you a chance before I go back in as well.
I'm just taking this in. I've made notes. No. the word that's coming to mind is a phrase I only heard or a term on the first day of our PGCE course here, when you said you've all probably at the minute got imposter syndrome. And it's going into a space where you think essentially you may not belong. And for me, I don't think there's anything you personally could do about it than just immerse yourself in it and get going with it and stay in it and understand that it might not be that bad, or you work to understand that you do actually belong in that space. And I was just thinking about some experiences that I thought which were similar, which, like you say, maybe looking back in hindsight, maybe it wasn't really, but I didn't have any reason to think that on the first day here. But certainly working in a few weeks, and one of my first days being asked to deliver basketball, a Brit being asked to teach lead basketball to a bunch of young American people was daunting. So I just said to them, okay, you tell me. I want to learn from you, and then we'll work from that in the following days. And it was brilliant. And it's just sort of about immersing yourself in that space. So I find quite valuable. Similar, actually, to coming on these podcasts, really. I know when Ash started inviting other teacher educators, I spoke with someone else who was on the first call that time, and we were like, oh, we didn't expect that, but it's, for me, it's all about coming back and just getting used to it and getting used to that environment, and all of a sudden it's more comfortable than it was.
It's very interesting, because I had the same experience on my teacher training when I went to a school, and there were some kids who'd played high school basketball, and they put me in charge of the basketball, you know, set, and I just, right. So the first thing is, you have to teach me how to play basketball so I can then take your basketball team. And we ended up, I left the school, they created a basketball team. We beat the regional champions in our first season when I was there on the PGC despite me, it was nothing to do with me. I facilitated the opportunity for them to play basketball, and they did the rest. And I think that's a really interesting and fantastic experience. But I think that imposter syndrome is relevant to all of us. I feel like a complete imposter as an academic. Everybody else is far cleverer than I am. As I said to you on the first day of the course, I have the lowest results in on this program, and I got rejected from the course that you're now on. So, you know, swings and right, you know, so you get it. I think everybody feels that. I've had conversations with, you know, Anne McPhail, and she's just the same. And you, as academics, you respect these people, but that notion of imposter. And I think in these spaces, it's even more important, is that we feel like, what have I got to say to this? What have I got to say to this this discussion as I say in the blog, as a white, British, middle class, well-educated, you know, Yorkshireman. So, but you have to say something. You've got to take that step and have the conversation, because it's easy to say nothing. Silence are not good. And I think I was a, I went from a, I think I was a latchkey kid for a while. I was never a bus kid, but then I went to, and this is an imposter thing. I did so badly at school in my first year of secondary school that I had to be put into the local boarding school. and I couldn't get in on my academic wit to be a day pupil, so I had to be a boarder. It was closer to walk to my house than it was to walk to the boarding house. And yet I was put into this environment, and in the end it was the making of me. But it was brilliant. But for 3 weeks I wasn't allowed to leave the school, and that, you know, that was a really difficult place to be. But had I stayed within the school I was, I would have not got through my 16-year-old qualifications, my GCSEs, let alone gone on. But I'm diverse. I'm, you know, they're different places. I'm still coming back to this. Steve was talking about going around the corner and being in no man's land. It was 50 yards and in no man's land. And the paper I'm reading for next week is the Ecology Dynamic Conceptualizations of Physical Education, which talks a lot to these spaces. So to answer your question, Brian, what do we do? And we've talked about trauma-informed pedagogies last week, so that's really interesting. But I'm still brought back to this cartography, and I'd like to have the map from Jumanji, or the Marauder's map from Harry Potter, that you open up and you say, okay, these are the spaces we're allowed to go into, and this is what's happening here, and this is where I can't go. And, you know, there's talk in the paper for next week about teaching people to swim in a swimming pool is nothing like open water swimming, because you don't understand the rip cut currents, and you don't understand the tides, and you don't understand the water is freezing in the UK, and all of those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And there's a hidden geography here. There's an in the know. And then we come back to this idea of legitimate peripheral participation in communities of culture, and then you start to apply this to a geographical sense, and the connections are scarily mind-bogglingly, I don't think that's even a word, I think I quite said that right, mind-boggling, no, someone else can say it for me, but that's where I was. So I'm just aware of time. We have gone a little bit beyond. I think we've probably got another 3 or 4 minutes, so let's just if anyone's got any final thoughts to bring to bear, Brian particularly, that'd be interesting.
Yeah, I'll just briefly add, Ash, I love how you put all of that together from a physical perspective, but always tell my students and my trainees that I work with is up here between the ears is as important. Because for a lot of our students, if they don't have the example in the curriculum, right, which is why we have to really work on decolonizing the curriculum and putting images in the curriculum, so that people can see that they have options to do these things. Because if mentally they feel like they can't do it, they will always revert back to what's most comfortable for them. And then they will never see themselves as, I'm going to get outside my space. So, no, I think all of that is right on point. And I always tell people that that mental piece, though, is representation is so undervalued in what we do. And students have to see themselves as part of that environment in order for them to help make space. So thank you, everyone.
And that's where our discussions ended. I'd like to thank Cam and Steve for their insights as teachers, Shri, Clancy and Risto as teacher educators, and Brian as the author for lending their thoughts to our discussion. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and hopefully you'll choose to catch up with us next time when we talk about an ecology dynamics conceptualization of physical education.